Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. Today we are going to talk about one of my favorite things to discuss in terms of agronomy. It's managing high pH fields. And the reason why I like talking about this is so many people will say, there's nothing you can do with high pH soil. Well, that's nonsense. Absolutely ridiculous. We're going to talk about how to manage those high pH fields for maximum yield on the show today. If you've got any questions for us, or if there's anything you'd like to talk about that's going on in your farm, our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can email us, radio@agphd.com, or send us a note on Twitter, AgPhD Media, Darren Hefty, or Brian Hefty. All right, so when it comes to managing high pH fields, Darren, I don't know what your top tip would be, but generally speaking, mine is we've got to, number one, find out what's the cause of the problem, and number two, in a lot of the cases, it's we've got to improve drainage. It's rare when we see a very well-drained field being really high in pH, and by high pH, by the way, it's all relative in terms of your crop. So for a blueberry grower who wants 5.5 pH or less, they'll say 6.5 is high for me. Okay, well, most of the time for corn, soybeans, and wheat, the big acreage crops, at least in the United States, we talk about 6.3 to 6.8 for pH. And by high, we're talking about almost anything over 7, especially over 7.5. So, Darren, what are your top couple things as we start this conversation?
Well, it's you got to do first things first. And if you can't get drainage right in your field, you got to fix that first. I'd like to say, hey, let's adjust that pH and move it down. And you can do that if you've got decent drainage moving through your field. But here's the challenge, Brian. I talk to growers all the time that say, well, everybody tells me I can't get my pH to go down. Not like in short order, it's going to take 20 years at least to do this. It took 40 years for it to get this high. It used to be good. Like many growers up in the Red River Valley on the North Dakota-Minnesota border, they'll say that, Brian. They'll say, you know, it was good 40 years ago, and now it's high, so it's going to take me 40 years of doing the right thing to turn it around. I completely disagree. I think we can do it a lot faster because I've seen it happen a lot faster. I'm not saying that it's cheap or easy, but let's just say that you had $200 an acre that you said, all right, my ground's worth $5,000 an acre. Would you pay $5,200 an acre for really good ground? Or versus $5,000 for just okay ground? Well, of course you'd pay the $5,200 and have way better ground right off the bat. Well, why won't you invest $200 in your ground to fix it? It may take that. Maybe you've got drainage in certain parts of the field that need fixing. Maybe you get drainage on the whole field, and it'll cost a little more than a couple $100. But let's just say that you got the drainage all right. Now we start talking about elemental sulfur, which can work in many situations.
Well,
now you've got to do some soil testing to determine
that. Let's talk about the situation. So high soil pH is typically caused by one of five things. Number one is poor drainage. When you have poor drainage, then a lot of times salts will build up and you get all kinds of issues. Number two, it's when your topsoil has disappeared. So it's common when you have erosion to get clear down to the subsoil, and all of a sudden, that's what you're soil testing, and you go, wow, my pH is high. How come my pH is so high? Well, because you're literally now in the subsoil. You lost all your topsoil. And anyway, that's number two. Number three, poor irrigation water quality. Number four, high magnesium. And number five, high sodium. So those are the five common things. And we want to know what's causing the problem on your farm. If you figure that out, then it's very, I shouldn't say easy to fix, but it's relatively simple process. It just may take a little time. So for example, if I got high sodium, we can correct sodic soils. It's just if your sodium percentage is at 2 versus if it's at 12, well, it's going to be a lot faster to fix the 2 than it is
the
12.
Well, yeah, you can't let the problem just get terrible
right
before you get after it. Now, if you did, even so, you can still get after it and try and do something.
Well,
because
yes,
what have you got
yes
to lose, number one? Nothing.
Yeah.
If you've got that much sodium out there, you're probably not even getting kochia to grow in those areas. You're not going to lose anything. You just as well give it a shot.
So anyway, when you've got high magnesium, high sodium, poor drainage, and in some cases even poor irrigation water quality, All of those things you can correct with better drainage. Now, better drainage may mean adding tile. It may mean, hey, my ground's already tiled, but I need to get more calcium out there. Calcium is a much bigger molecule than magnesium, for example. And then you have better porosity in your soil, and some of these salts can drain out much easier if you have good calcium levels. So I'm just trying to say it, you got to flush out the things that are bad over time. And the other big key that I want to stress to you today is if you have high pH, one of the first things you need to do also is look at everything else you need to do to raise a good crop, like balancing your soil nutrients. So if you're not taking complete soil tests, for example, if all you're looking at is N, P, and K, well, maybe it's something else, and you need to make sure you're doing that right. Because just always keep this in mind. The more healthy roots your plants produce, the more organic acids that they will release, which naturally lowers the soil pH. So what I'm saying is you just try to do everything else you can to raise a decent crop, and the crop is going to force the soil to start lowering its pH. It's going to get it more into an equilibrium, which is what you want.
And, you know, there's a lot of things too, Brian, that can be done right around that root zone. You're mentioning how plants themselves are kicking out these organic acids. Certainly beneficial soil microbes out there will work in a variety of ways right around that root zone too. And many times we see farmers starting with, hey, let's deal with what's in the row here. And I think that's okay. But like you mentioned before, if you're willing to just invest a little bit of money and really go for this.
Well, yeah, but we got to be specific. Okay, here's a specific thing. Elemental sulfur. Yes.
Yeah, let's talk about elemental sulfur. Let's just say you've got a small little 20-acre field, 40-acre field. In this geography, that's a small field. Some areas, that's a big field. But still, it's not that many acres. You focus on that and you learn, and then you can start doing it on your whole farm.
But here's the thing. I'm gonna point out just a couple things with elemental sulfur. One, you have to have good drainage. If you're going to use elemental sulfur and you don't have good drainage, you're wasting your money. Okay. Number two, with elemental sulfur, you want to find a material that is very small for the particle size. Okay. So you got to have great drainage, tiny, tiny, tiny particle size for elemental sulfur. Do those things and it'll work.
We're talking about managing high pH soils on today's show. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Every farmer knows there are lots of steps to having a perfect season. Don't let your fertilizer plan be the step that trips you up. For over 35 years, AgroLiquid has had the experts and the products that'll help you move closer to your target. No matter when you apply fertilizer, no matter how, you'll hit the bullseye. AgroLiquid can help you increase yields and crop quality. To learn more, go to agroliquid.com. AgroLiquid moves you closer to your target.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? Brian Ryberg from Buffalo Lake, Minnesota has done just that. Here's his story.
We began using a soil warrior on our farm fall of 2014. We've seen many benefits from better water infiltration, a lot less hours on equipment, fuel, able to reduce our fertilizer side. So it's really simplified our operation.
See what makes Soil Warrior different and better at soilwarrior.com.
A pasture should have two things, grass and cattle. No weeds, no brush. That's why Chaparral Herbicide offers the broadest spectrum weed control available. It controls weeds other products can miss, like buckbrush and Canada thistle. And less weeds and brush in your pastures means more forage, so you spend less on feed. Chaparral also suppresses seed heads, lessening the effects of fescue toxicosis, all while providing season-long residual control. Visit noweedsnobrush.com today and learn more about Chaparral.
As your corn crop grows and the ear begins to form, potassium is at a high demand, almost as high as nitrogen. The same is true for soybeans, with similar high demands of potassium during pod fill. Don't fall behind. Ensure your crop is getting its potassium with Catalyst. Catalyst by Actagro has been shown to be the best at entering the leaf when compared to other leading potassium products. Visit k-supercharged.com for more information.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about managing high pH soils. But before we do, we want to talk grain markets just a little bit. We've got our good friend Scott Harms with us. He is with Grain PhD and Archer Financial Services. Scott, how are you doing today?
Good, Brian. Good afternoon.
All right, so just getting right into this thing, what's going on with China right now? There's constant talk out there about our grain markets and China. Where do things stand right now?
Well, we when news of a trade deal started to leak into the market a couple Fridays ago, so we do have the basis for an agreement in place. Corn market, I think it was 20 higher, close to 20 higher that day. That was on the heels of a negative reaction to the USDA report the day before. But then soybean reaction was a little more muted. But officially, it looks like we're looking at they've announced that there's going to be a phase one of a deal, and that's going to include $40 to $50 billion worth of agricultural products. They don't have it finalized yet, so that's what the market's waiting for. It's good news. Market reacted, but we really need to see the actual sales being made. I think the real good news probably in the whole deal was some of the stickier issues regarding intellectual property and financial services issues. They seem to be resolved in this first phase. Some of the progress was made on the technology transfer, but that's going to be pushed back to the next phase. So they decided that in order to get a deal done, they needed to break it up in these little phases. They'll negotiate phase two after they get phase one signed. That is expected to be signed next month when they meet in Chile. This morning, also on the positive side, it was announced that China was going to offer to their private importers tariff-free quotas of up to 10 million metric tons of beans ahead of the next round of trade talks. Now, whether that's a carrot to get things moving along or whether it's a sign that they're fearful of South American supplies not being available, the good news is that now anyone in China, not just government agencies, can step in and buy beans and import. And, so we should start to see, this should be a sign that some business starts to show up very soon. And again, I think the market's waiting for that confirmation. You see boats in the water before there's any major reaction.
Well, honestly, I always think of China in general as being pretty good negotiators. And when I talk to Brazilian farmers and they tell me the premiums they're getting, I go, yeah, China's not going to tolerate that very long. So they're going to try to work something out with the U.S. So at least seems like they've got two countries leveraging. If you only have one supplier, you're pretty well stuck with whatever price they want to give you. So I really think we'll get something worked out with China here eventually. Okay, another topic that I had for you. There was a big snowstorm here, a little over a week ago, and we had frost. I mean, like a fairly hard frost. And a lot of agronomists I talked to throughout our region said, hey, it was 20, 30% of the corn that could not take a frost at that point. Is that into the market? How much of that you think is into the market? What are you hearing about that whole cold front that came through a week or so ago?
You know, I don't even believe that we began to even trade the impact of that cold snap and
I agree.
The snowfall in those areas. I have not heard any estimates on beans, but some of the analysts have come together on the corn side of it and estimating anywhere from 150 million bushels to 400 million bushels of losses. And if we're on the high side of that number, you know, that's going to drop carryover number in corn close to or below 1.5 billion bushel, and we'll have to go through another price adjustment if that's the case. So we clearly, in my mind, haven't traded at least that topside number. The problem is because of the demand side, the demand issues we have, and the market just does not get excited. It's more of a wait and see, and the USDA, at least to this point, has failed to give us any confirmation, at least the confirmation that those of us in the trade expect, of lower production. And now with the problems that occurred in the northwestern part of the belt and even, you know, further south in the western part of the belt where the growing season ended, we haven't been able to put numbers on that. Until the USDA puts numbers on it that the market can see, I don't think you're going to see that big round of buying in anticipation. That's just not the way this market has traded this year. A lot of times you put premium into the market and you take it out if it isn't necessary. In this particular case, it's been a lot of chop, especially the last couple months after the big move we had this spring and late spring and early summer. No, I don't believe we started to trade, and I think the impact could be big. And now we're dealing with, as everyone knows, we're dealing with these high winds, and we've got a lot of corn and soybeans still out there in the field and very vulnerable to weather as we move forward. So we're just continuing to take another chunk out of this soybean yield that I think is, and corn and soybean yields that I think were already overstated to before we hit this recent bout of bad weather. So it's just it's a market that wants confirmation. Once it gets it, you know, be ready and be prepared, because the market will react. It will have to go through an adjustment, and especially if we can get something solved on the demand side of it, it makes it so much easier when we get, if we have a good solid demand base that we don't have to ignore and be concerned about. Then the markets are going to be more sensitive to these supply side issues. But right now, especially as it relates to corn, we don't have a demand program that excites the trade. So it's not going to allow the market to move sharply higher until we do.
Well, I think one of the most telling things is all the ethanol plants are around me. I shouldn't say all. Many of the ethanol plants around me have a positive basis right in the middle of harvest. I've never seen anything like that in my life, not even close. So I think that should show the trade overall, if people are paying attention. Oh my gosh, there is not corn out there. Normally it's 50 cents under at harvest. Right now, in a lot of cases, it's 5 or 10 cents over in South Dakota. Yeah, that's craziness. I mean, what do you think about all that when you hear those kind of numbers?
I agree. We've been saying that all summer. We finally got confirmation of that with the September 1st, the stocks report, where they cut back 300 million bushels. That showed us that the corn isn't out there. Now, and I think they are having problems getting access to corn. We're hearing facilities shutting down, and it happens this time of year. Normally, this year they're attributing it to the RFA. Waiver system that were this small refinery waivers that were put out there by the Trump administration, so they're using that as an excuse. But perhaps the real reason is they are having trouble accessing corn and staying viable for this time of year, and perhaps they'll be right back online once new crop supplies are available. But there's no question that, you know, farmers are dealing with a different issue this year, and that's basis opportunities.
Yep.
That's something that we haven't seen, you know, we've seen all this year, we haven't seen in previous years, where you can take advantage of it strong in your area. Go ahead and move that product. If they want it bad enough, let them have it and re-own it on paper, and you don't have to mess around storing it, especially if it's a new crop situation. You know, we don't know how, you know, the storability is for the crop is going to be this
exactly.
year. There's a lot of maintenance.
Yep.
So if they really want it, just go ahead and give it to them and use a buyback program of futures and options, get some long calls in place, and take your risk on that side of it rather than your risk of storing it in the bin and having to spend all winter, you know, worrying about the condition.
Yeah, there was one grain elevator probably, I don't know, a couple hundred miles north of me. Just today they announced no shrink below 20% moisture. They're taking it in, no drying charge, nothing. I mean, people are desperate for this corn. So talk to us for maybe another minute about marketing advice as we kind of go through these times that we just haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think being flexible is important. You know, there's going to be pricing opportunities that we need to be able to maybe take advantage of, but you don't necessarily have to get married to, because we still don't know the depth of the yield cut that we expect. Maybe it occurs in January. We get a reaction in November that creates one selling opportunity. But you want to be flexible in case there's bigger cuts in January. And then also on the flexibility side, like I mentioned, on the basis, you know, watch your basis. If they're going to give you an opportunity that you've never seen before, you know, you may have to just consider, even though you have storage on farm and you have that capability, go ahead and get it priced if they're willing to push that basis, and then, you know, and then reown it on paper, reopen your upside. The other thing we're watching very closely is opportunities in the 2020 crop, specifically. We're looking at the these $24 puts at 15 cents. If we can get a push higher, you can set your price floor at $3.85. It's not a glamorous price floor, but it gives you plenty of time to market that grain throughout the year and better opportunities.
We've been talking to Scott Harms with Grain PhD, and if you're interested in talking to Scott or any of the grain risk specialists at Grain PhD, just call them at 844-GRAIN-01 or go to grainphd.com. Thanks for the time today, Scott. Really appreciate it.
All right.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Your grain bin fans can cost you a lot. High electric bills from running when conditions are not ideal, shrinkage from overdried grain, and spoiled grain all take money out of your pocket. With the Steps GMS app temperature humidity switch, get your bin fans to start making you money. Only run Vans when the conditions are right. Eliminate shrink and spoilage in your bins. Deliver grain in top condition at market moisture. When every dollar counts, you need Steps GMS. Contact us today at stepsgms.com.
For generations, your family has given their all to create a farming legacy. The fields now in your care are a heavy responsibility to sustain. You can't control when or how rain falls, but you can ensure your fields remain productive by taking water drainage into your own hands with the SoilMax Gold Digger Tile Plow. SoilMax Tile Plows bring a quick return in dollars, but no ROI is greater than a family's farming future. Let SoilMax ensure your greatest investment continues. Visit SoilMax.com to learn more.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, marestail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
If you're a rancher who's obsessed with keeping your pastures clear, turn to Grazon Next Herbicide. It offers superior broadleaf weed control, so instead of thinking about weeds, you can think about the money you'll save growing more grass and buying less feed. Used early in the season, Grazon Next also provides residual activity that controls newly emerged weed seedlings, giving you season-long control. Start enhancing your land while you protect it. Visit leavetheweedstous.com to learn more about Grazon Next. Always read and follow label directions.
When it comes to my weed control, I know a head start can go a long way. That's why I spray early, so I can keep control all season long with a Roundup Ready Extend crop system, the system that makes the difference. This is my field.
Choose the Roundup Ready Extend crop system for control of more weeds than any other soybean system. Featuring Extendamax herbicide with vapor grip technology to manage tough-to-control weeds, including up to 14 days of soil activity, along with the field-proven performance of Roundup Ready to Extend soybeans. Now you have the right tools to extend your weed control and extend your yield with the system that makes the difference. Learn how you can put the system to work in your field when you visit RoundupReadyExtend.com. Extendamax is a restricted-use pesticide. Performance may vary. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. Check local regulations for specific requirements in your state.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. We're talking about managing high pH fields, and I think this year of all years, with all the prevent plant acres that are out there, when you look at the soil tests that are coming in out of some of these fields, the pH is not in a good spot in many of them, and unfortunately in a lot of them it is high. We're talking about how to deal with that on today's program. Also, if you have any questions, you can give us a call. Easy for me to say, at 844-44-AG-PHD, or send us an email, radio@agphd.com. Let's head down to Kansas right now. We've got Dorvar Ruiz-Diaz, a soil fertility specialist with Kansas State. Dorvar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, talking about this high pH issue, I know talking to growers across Kansas, we talked to some with irrigation, and they're fighting different situations with their water quality and other things. And we talked to the dryland farmers, and they seem to have some different challenges as well. Talk to us about your state and what you're seeing in terms of soil pH, and especially what you're doing in these high pH situations.
Yes, high pH is certainly a problem for us in many parts of Kansas, especially as we go west. Drier conditions, pH tend to be naturally high. And it is a bit of a challenge. Obviously, in the case of high pH, it's different than low pH. With low pH, we can apply lime and fix the issue fairly easily. But high pH tend to be a little bit more of a challenge. Most cases, lowering the pH of the soil will not be economical. And so we typically will tend to look at best management practice in terms of how we can still make productive in those soils and make it work essentially without making it economical management in general. A few of the things that we see typically in our environment, especially we're looking at crops like soybean and sorghum, they tend to be more sensitive to those very high pH situations, and we're talking really in that situation limitations of nutrient availability, especially micronutrients and more specifically iron. So we start to see iron chlorosis problems, again, especially in soybean and sorghum. So that's tend to be kind of the some of the main challenges. And for us in Kansas, as we do see more soybean acres moving west, this is something that we tend to see more often.
Yeah, you're right. That cropping mix is certainly changing a little bit, and that does raise some concerns for growers they may not have had in the past. You know, the other thing in terms of what is short for nutrients, I think about what we have too much of also. Like, it could be sodium, it could be magnesium, it could be calcium. What nutrients do you see being too prevalent in some of these soils that are leading to this high pH?
Right, and that's the other part of those high pH. Of course, we do have soils that are naturally high pH, may not have essentially issues with sodium, like you mentioned, but we do have some especially irrigated fields that maybe the quality of the water may not be the best, and so we start to see increasing sodium content. So that's another problem that we see with those high pH, and we have to essentially deal with the sodium issue. In that situation, we do make some management recommendations, such as applying sources like gypsum, so we can replace that sodium by calcium, which is ultimately what we like to see in the soil. But going back to some of those soils that are naturally high and where we do see iron chlorosis problems, management options that we have typically start with choosing the right varieties. That always tends to be the first step. What varieties of soybean sorghum hybrids will be performing better in those higher pH environments? We also do have a lot of success using chelated fertilizers, micronutrients like iron in those high pH soils, especially in contact with the seed for both soybean and sorghum, providing excellent benefit, especially, again, if we focus on those high pH areas, because that's one thing that we see a lot in our some of our fields in Kansas that may not be the entire field that has that issue. And obviously, we want to be economical. We want to focus on those problematic areas. Typically, the producer will know that based on history and target those areas for management. With either fertilizer applications, chelated sources of iron, variety selection, and so on. A few other things that we also see related to high pH and where we try to improve management, a lot of times relate to phosphorus. When it comes to phosphorus, obviously we do have soil tests. P is the main management option that we have for managing phosphorus, but it becomes more important what type of test we are using. And typically we'll recommend using Olsen soil test, which is really a soil test that was developed for higher pH soils, do a much better job compared to Bray 1, for example. And again, once we're getting to those pH of 7.4 or higher, we really want to pay attention to what kind of soil test method we are using, and follow up with the soil testing lab to make sure we are using the proper soil test methods. Obviously, things like placement of phosphorus fertilizer also becomes important, as we may have some potential issues of maybe some level of tie-up of phosphorus. So we do want to pay attention to placement of phosphorus becomes really important.
That's a great tip, too, especially as a lot of farmers are out pulling soil tests right now to get the right tests run in these high pH zones and also start thinking about placement. I love the comment, too, about variable rate fertility. We certainly see pH changes in different zones out in the field and should be managed accordingly. Different areas getting different management techniques to try to be economical as you're doing this. Dorvar, we could talk all day on this. This has been great. I really appreciate having you on today. Thank you so much. Good luck here the rest of the fall. All right, let's head out to Colorado State. We've got Ron Meyer with us right now. Ron, how are you doing? Oh, I think I might have lost the phone line there. Let me try one more time.
I have you. Can you
right.
hear me?
There you go. Now I got you, Ron. We're talking high pH soils, and I can't imagine that Kansas is a whole lot different than Colorado. I would assume you've got some dry land areas fighting this and also some irrigated guys.
Yeah. So eastern Colorado has serious infestation of high pH soils. And we've got some rolling soils conditions, and especially our hilltops, which, you know, they're eroded. And so we do have those hilltops are showing us sometimes pH levels as high as 8. And so that's very high. And we have to be cognizant of that when we're choosing crops.
All right. When you think about that, you're right. We got to deal with this year of, all right, let's be cautious about what we're putting out there for a crop and so forth. But what's the next right move for a guy that says, okay, I want to fix this thing, and it may not happen overnight, but maybe it's a 10-year process for me. I just want to start making the right decisions. Are there some things that guys should be doing a little differently to try to help bring that pH back down?
Yeah, so you're right. You know, so lots of times our soils are variable on the fields, and so we may have high pH close to 8 on the hilltops, and we might be close to 7.2 down below. And so on average, you know, we're probably 7.5. So the big step is know where the problem areas are, and many producers know that just because of the cropping history. But they can soil sample, you know, and group those fields, and so you know where the problem areas are, and then apply accordingly. So we use a lot of sulfur, and we use some other micronutrients too. Iron is another popular one for us. And we're starting to see some variable rate fertility taking place, and I think that's starting to pay off. And so they don't have to put it on where they don't need it. They just put it on where it's needed, and saves them some money and bumps yields up at the same time.
Now, you mentioned erosion. Is this partially getting solved by reduced tillage now, where we're going no-till or strip-till in some of these areas?
That's right. Yeah, those soils, they're eroded because of those summer storms that come through and dump a bunch of rain in a short period of time. So yeah, we're seeing more reduced till, more no-till production out in the eastern plains. It makes the reason that the guys are switching to that is it makes them some money. So it's a moisture-conserving strategy, but it also makes sense from a soil standpoint as far as holding soils in place.
Yeah, a lot of different things that are being done to stop this erosion issue. I'm glad you brought that up, Ron. I've got some eroded ground that I picked up just a few years back, and we've been trying to keep our tillage to an absolute minimum out there to try to make sure we don't lose any more of that topsoil. I've been talking with Ron Meyer at Colorado State. Ron, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on. Have a great rest of your fall. We're talking about managing high pH fields. We'll talk a little more about that right after this.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, marestail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Ambac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
If your fertilizers aren't formulated to maximize your efficiency, if you can't mix all the PK and micros your crop needs into one prescription application, if you have to add products to improve and invigorate your soil biology, then you need to expect more from your fertilizer. With AgroLiquid's advanced technology, you can expect more, a lot more. Make the most of your crop nutrition. With AgroLiquid, to find a crop nutrition expert near you, visit agroliquid.com.
When looking for someone to help with your risk management, a key component to look for is patience. Patience to bring you along in the process at your own speed. Patience to learn about your operation, and patience to not only discuss what strategies may be effective for your plan, but why they would be effective. That's the strength of Grain PhD. I'm Darren Hefty. When you're ready to become more engaged in your risk management, Grain PhD can assist you with that process. Visit grainphd.com to learn more.
We didn't get to the moon by accepting that man can't fly, and we sure didn't get the car by settling for the horse. Progress isn't driven by accepting things as they are. It's driven by asking questions. At Indigo, we're working with farmers to question the entire agriculture system, to reimagine everything from soil to sale. Yeah, we like the big projects. Go to indigoag.com/questions to find out more. Indigo, from questions we grow.
Bean growers continue to see yield loss from white mold across the Midwest this season. To maximize next year's crop, a white mold prevention strategy that includes Contans WG soil fungicide is a must for your farming operation. Applying Contans this fall to reduce the sclerotia in the soil is the most effective way to stop white mold at its source. Start a Contans white mold control strategy this fall or pay for it later in lost yield.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio, and we are discussing managing high pH soils. And Brian, this is one that a lot of guys say, oh man, it's tough. I don't know what to do here. I got this big challenge that people are telling me I can't do, but
sure, it's tough. I mean, there aren't a lot of things on the farm that are super crazy easy, but yeah, I mean, you got to look at why do we have a problem and what can we do to get that problem solved.
All right, let's head over to Iowa. We've got Keith Rohrer with us with Dry Run Drainage, and bet you can guess where this one's going. Hey, Keith, how are you today?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good. Hey, you're the guy that gets the call on a lot of these high pH situations. Guys say, man, I got a drainage issue out here. I know there are a lot of expectations that guys have. Sometimes they don't want to put the budget behind really getting the fix right. But what are you doing in these high pH spots? Are you finding guys that say, hey, in this area of the field, we just need to put the tile a lot closer?
Yeah, I mean, that's typically the issue. Those high pH soils are a lot tighter, and so therefore your tile spacings need to be much closer. You know, at the top of the hill, away from that, maybe in a sandier soil, we can be spaced out a lot further. But usually those are the low spots of pooled water and, yeah, require a tighter spacing.
How about drainage coefficient? Do you take some of those areas and say, you know what, you want a half-inch drainage coefficient everywhere else, but we better step our game up in those spots?
Well, I mean, that is definitely something we look at and try to pursue, you know, if possible, but budget factors sometimes become an issue, and so trying to focus how we do that, and so some areas I've worked, I try to get, you know, above those low areas so that we're intercepting that water early and re-diverting it, and then, yeah, basically needing to increase our coefficient in that area so we see a bigger yield benefit and gain, and therefore a quicker return on the investment, and that's the thing that's biggest. Trying to show and let the guys know that, yes, up front we're spending a little more, but the return on your investment will be better in the long run having that drained and properly working.
I see a lot of guys working on surface drainage, and that's certainly not a bad thing, but we still end up on a year like this where we get so much water. Wow, I saw a lot of erosion coming out of some of those spots. If we could get that water to move down, it really helps. Do you talk about maybe a shallower placement of the tile, or what are some of the things that you do to get more of that water moving down through the soil?
Yeah, so shallower sometimes is good. Sometimes we need to look and just dig in the soil profile and see what's there. I've found in some areas, actually this year, I've had some sand veins that are, you know, long and deep and basically a natural path for drainage. And that water has been coming through the soil profile for probably a couple years and has hit a clay area and causing a problem. And so getting into those areas and finding what, you know, area needs the tile, like I said, getting a backhoe out there and digging down, we found in some spots that we needed to be 4.5 feet deep. And then we were in that sand layer collecting that water as opposed to 3.5 feet, we were stuck in a clay layer. And then other areas, yeah, just being shallower so that it's less time for that water to travel. But getting a good idea of what your soils are and you're dealing with is very critical.
All right, so 2019, I know what kind of a year it was for farming. How about for drainage tile contractors? How has 2019 been?
Oh, it's been brutal. It's required a lot of extra horsepower to help you pull through those muddy spots, and just takes a lot longer. You know, when your water lines are full, The tile is harder to handle. You know, when a 12-inch tile is empty, it's easy to move around. When it's loaded, it's a challenge.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Keith, we're sure thinking about you guys out getting this work done and trying to help make some of this ground a little more farmable and hopefully bring this pH down along the way, too. Thanks for the time today. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. Have a good one.
Let's head over to Indiana. We've got Roger Wenning with us, who also does some tile insulation. In addition to farming, Roger, have you even had time to put tile in between all the farming challenges this year?
Not very much. We do most of ours. There's very little wheat, so most of our tiling happens between harvest and planting. And the last two winters have been very challenging to find weather that permits it. We've done some, but it's been interesting.
I think about Indiana, and there's a lot of guys that are working with cover crops over there now, and I believe you are as well. We get questions about this all the time. If I'm doing cover crops, do you see any issues or downside for my drain tile that's under the fields?
Actually, it's great benefits. What we're finding, especially in the southeastern part where we have a lot of real heavy soils, we have a very limiting layer at about 2.5 feet that water will not go through on a lot of our soils on these Claremonts and Abenbergs. So we'll put in there, but we're finding the cover crops are breaking all those hard pans up and allowing the water to flow down. But if you hit that limit layer, the water can't go anywhere. So by putting tile in, this water can get to it easy, much easier with the no-till cover crops, and then having that tile gets it out of there, which then allows your crop roots and your microbes and everything else in the soil air to live in.
Sure. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting. As we change farming practices, it's good to do a little digging and see what's going on below ground and also just pay attention to things like your outlets to see how things are working. So what has the last couple of months been? Now, did you guys get hot and dry there where you're at, Roger?
Yeah, we were terrible wet until about the 4th of July. We planted all of our beans twice and some three times. All the corn was planted June. I mean, everything was late. And then it shut off. We got 1.5 inches of rain yesterday. That's the most rain we've had, well, actually, total since then. Wow. September, we had about 0.1 inches total. So, yeah, it's been challenging, but crops are coming in better than I expected. Not good, but better than expected.
Yep, so that leaves you some time now to get out and do the tiling. So what do you find with growers with high pH soils? Are these becoming the priority areas for guys where they've got pH challenges?
Actually, around here, there's very little. Most of it is low pH. It's more of a challenge here than the high pH in our type soils.
Okay.
But the tile actually helps. We put lime on. And by getting that out, we have a lot better movement of earthworms. And they're the guys that'll work that lime and stabilize the pH. Because there is some higher pH deep, and it's low up high. So,
interesting.
By getting that extra water out, we're allowing our earthworms to move and so, yeah, they do mitigate some of those issues.
You know, we were just talking about that earlier today about prevent plant acres, and we've just been concerned about all the living things in the soil when the soil's just been covered up by water for so long for some of these guys. So that's a good comment. I'm glad you made that. And I like, you know, a lot of the stuff that you've been talking about here, too, just trying to focus on that soil health and getting things to move through the soil. Everything, whether it's a high pH or low pH soil, just functions so much better. Roger, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on here. I know fall is a super busy time for your operation, and I guess stay safe this fall, and hopefully everything goes well.
Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Enjoy thanks. Enjoy talking to you.
You bet. You know, Brian, Roger brought up a few different things, and I thought about that too. You know, as we've got different pH at different levels, you know, we're talking about managing high pH, and for most growers, they're looking at the top 6 inches. We may have really high pHs down deep in the soil that we need to deal with too, which could be symptomatic of several different things. Maybe it's poor drainage down low, like Roger talked about. They had a thick clay level that was really tough to move things through. It could be, you know, a
high
lot of
magnesium. Yeah. It could be high magnesium. If it's high magnesium, it's probably not worth fixing. I wouldn't get too worried about it. But if it is, a salt level, if it's sodic, I mean, those kind of things, you go, hey, if I don't fix it here, what's going to happen is it's going to keep moving up, and eventually my topsoil is going to be in trouble too. And let's also not forget, your topsoil, like on our farm, is only 6 or 8 inches. So we got roots a lot deeper. It'd be nice to have that subsoil in at least halfway's good shape too. All right, we're going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag coming up next.
Find your full potential and increase your bottom line with branded generic fungicides from Atticus LLC. Fungal diseases can be devastating, but Acadia, Slant, and Talaris 4.5F from Atticus deliver lasting, broad-spectrum fungi control so your soybeans, sugar beets, and dry beans can thrive. Growers across the region count on Atticus for relevant and reliable products that deliver results every time. Ask your local retailer about Atticus products and visit AtticusLLC.com to learn more. For value-based solutions you can trust, turn to Atticus. Always read and follow label instructions.
No one has to explain stress to a farmer. That's like explaining wind shear to a pilot. Now, Mother Nature stresses corn the way markets, bankers, and politics can stress you. But there's a proven way to reduce stress. With Headline Amp fungicide, you'll see the difference. It decreases stress from disease, drought, hail, and heat, so your corn can focus on what matters most, better yields. Talk to your local rep about Headline Amp fungicide and BASF Plant Health. Always read and follow label directions.
There's a new authority in town. New Authority Supreme Herbicide from FMC combines the best-in-class Group 14 PPO herbicide with the newest Group 15 herbicide for lasting residual control of water hemp, Palmer amaranth, kochia, pigweed, and other tough-resistant weeds. This exclusive liquid premix of single-application chemistries protects your soybeans from pre-plant to harvest. It also protects your bottom line. Authority Supreme Herbicide qualifies for the agronomic and economic incentives of the FMC Freedom Pass program. Rule your soybean fields with more authority than ever before with Authority Supreme Herbicide from FMC. More powerful preventative control isn't on the horizon, it's here. Visit your FMC retailer or fmccrop.com to learn more. Always read and follow all label directions, restrictions, and precautions for use. Authority Supreme Herbicide is not registered for sale or use in California. FMC and Authority are trademarks of FMC Corporation or an affiliate.
We plant corn in Iowa, spray soybeans in Illinois.
We pull calves in Kansas, farrow hogs in Minnesota.
We raise rice in Arkansas, rye in Canada, and wheat everywhere in between.
We farm millions of acres across North America
and build every piece of Case IH equipment.
Built by farmers, for farmers. Case IH. Rethink productivity.
The last thing you want after harvesting your grain is to spoil it before it goes to market. The Grain Temp Guard from Farm Shop MFG is a low-cost bin monitoring solution that tracks temperature and humidity and alerts you when conditions exceed safe thresholds. Visit farmshopmfg.com.
Tired of that old warped poly boom ruining your spray applications? Express Boom from Hypro is a fully assembled stainless steel boom that ensures an even application of chemicals every time. Don't wait another season, upgrade today. Hypro, helping you spray better.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. We've been talking about high pH soils. We're going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag in just 1 second. We've got a call right now. This is Tony over in Minnesota. Tony, how's it going?
Oh, another beautiful day in the upper Midwest, right?
Excellent. I wish you weren't being sarcastic. Hey, you're doing some soil sampling, though. Have you been able to get out in fields much already?
No, we're getting close. We just harvested our first corn the past couple of days, and now it's time to start soil sampling a little bit.
Okay.
So I got a question for you. I've used your Ag PhD Soils app, you know, for years. Love it. But also thinking about trying another lab for some of my sampling. Is it possible to do that with your app?
Well, at this point, I don't believe so. I think it's just working through one lab, but I know we had done a little bit this fall,
too. Well, you could use
too,
it to set up grid points if you want to do that. But, yeah, in terms of the data filtering through it, no, it's not. And the reason why is just the interpretation of the data. Because, basically, I'll just put it to you this way. Darren and I spent a lot of time working on, okay, when the stuff comes in, recommendations going through Midwest Labs. Well, if it's another lab, now we've got to tweak all our recommendations, all our advice, every last thing. And it's just, it's a lot of work. And the reason why I picked Midwest Labs, number one, we'd worked with them for a long time. Number two, they're like by far the largest lab in North America. So we just figured so many samples are running through there and it's in our region and everything. We're just going to do that and call it good. So someday, could we have something else? Yes, we're actually looking at that. But for this season, we don't have it set up so the data would run through there. But again, you could use it to certainly pick your grid points and go from there.
Can you pull the shapefile off for the grid points?
You should be able to pull the shapefile, yes. Janelle, we could have somebody follow up with Tony on that too after we get done talking to him here for more of the details. Because I off the top of my head, I'm going to tell you, I'm 99% sure that you should be able to do that.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. The crops are wet here, by the way, and so is the ground. So.
it's really no different than here. Now, I will say this, though, Tony, and it was funny. I was just talking to an agronomist yesterday, and he goes, I've been talking to guys about, maybe harvesting wet beans, and they just can't believe you can put beans in a bin and air dry them down. And I said, absolutely, Ken. We've been doing that the last few years. It's amazing. We've harvested a lot of our beans the last 2 years at 17% moisture, thrown them into the bin with automatic bin fan controls. In 3 weeks, they're down to 13. It's awesome. And the other thing is on corn, this year, I didn't want to start as early as we did, but our average moisture so far on our first third of the farm has been 25%. Now, fortunately, everything is below 25 that we have to do yet. But I'm just saying, we harvested stuff. I didn't want to, but it's like, man, we got to get going on fertilizer and tillage and everything else. We're down to, just a week left of October. So we did it. And right or wrong, I guess I'm glad that we at least got some acres out. But yes, we feel
I'm
what you're going through.
29.
Oh.
29 so far.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So, well, good luck. Hopefully things start drying out. You bet.
All right. Let's dive into the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's now mailbag time with Brian and Darren.
All right, Brian, got some feedback here from Kevin. He said he had a great show that you were talking the other day on calcium and gypsum. Wanted to get your thoughts on the interaction between calcium and phosphorus. According to Mulder's chart, the relationship is antagonistic, but it sounded like Mr. Goff thought otherwise. Is it just the sulfur's impact on the high pH doing that?
All right. Well, let's first say this. All nutrients are not antagonistic. Nutrient is antagonistic to every other nutrient in all situations. So the whole thing is all these nutrients work together, and this is what I mean by that. You want to have a balanced diet for your, I'm using the word diet like I would in human health, you want a balanced diet out there for your plants. So if your plants are ridiculously short on calcium, that's a problem. If they're ridiculously short on phosphorus, that's a problem. But in terms of calcium and phosphorus being antagonistic, the only way that they would be antagonistic according to the Mulder chart is basically this. If you way overdo it on phosphorus, well, now you're going to create a shortage if you just had kind of a normal level of calcium because you haven't way overdone it on calcium. All right, if that makes sense. But I think where Goff is going is he talks about calcium because it's important for almost all these nutrients to kind of get into the plant, and you've got to have a good level of calcium always. So I guess let's just put it this way. We want to have good levels of calcium and good levels of phosphorus out there, and we're going to do fine. Calcium is important not just for the plant, but it's also important for soil health. So don't just think about the plants. Think about the soil. If you don't have a good amount of calcium in that soil, that field is going to be poorly drained. The pH is going to be off, just like we talked about today. You got to have the right amount of calcium out there, and then things will start getting in line. You'll have, when you have better drainage, that basically means you have more air in the soil. And then your microbes, all that living stuff in the soil is really going to thrive, in addition, obviously, to your plant roots and plants. So I don't really look at it as antagonistic. I look at it as synergistic.
All right. Thanks for the question. Really appreciate that. Got one from Russell here, and I think this is an interesting one here. As we were talking about different pH levels today, Russell's got a different soil test question. He said, I've heard you guys explain before how to figure the amount of fertilizer needed to raise potassium-based saturation, but would ask if you could explain it one more time. I've recently gotten some soil samples back through the Ag PhD Soils app and wanted to try to figure this out. And I'd say this too, Russell, before Brian digs into the potassium. You can use this exact same formula to help yourself build magnesium levels. When I look at the three samples that you sent, were anywhere from 3 to 6% magnesium on base saturation. That needs to be over 10 and probably up to 12. So we're going to need to add a lot of magnesium out there at the same time.
Yeah, now here's the thing. His cation exchange capacity is low. It's in the range of 7 to 12. I shouldn't even say low. It's low to medium, okay? 7 to 12. So there's not... It's not like 20 or 30 or 40 or anything like that. It's low. And when it's low, then we see magnesium low a fair amount too. Magnesium is really low, especially in the Midwestern United States and Southern Canada. It's really low when we have light or sandy soils. Usually if you have heavy soils, we have lots of clay and the clay has lots of magnesium in it. But anyway, okay, so in this one example, he's got 1% base saturation K. He's got 46 parts per million of potassium. So for super simple math, let's just call that, let's round it to 50 parts per million. Okay, so if he's at 1% and he wants to go to 4, all you need to do is take that number 50 times 4, that'd be 200, divided by 1, still 200. Okay, and there you go. You want to take your parts per million basically from 50 up to 200, and you should be relatively close to 4% base saturation K. So you got to get it roughly 150 parts per million of potassium out there, and keep in mind you convert parts per million to pounds per acre by multiplying times 2. So you need roughly 300 pounds of actual potassium, and that should solve it all in one shot. But the big thing here is trying to identify, you know, what's most limiting for you. Well, when you're at 1%, I can promise you lack of K is hurting your yield. When you're at 4% magnesium, I can promise you lack of magnesium is hurting your yield. But the problem is you're also very low on sulfur, you're very low on zinc, you're very low on manganese, you're very low on copper, and you're very low on boron. So there are a lot of things here that need to be addressed. So rather than spending all your money on potassium, I guess is where I'm going, you might want to get some kind of blend out there that addresses as many of these, whatever I said there, 7 or 8 nutrient deficiencies as possible, because right now, every single one of those is a yield-limiting factor on your field, I will guarantee you.
All right. Thanks for the question, Russell. We really appreciate that. Thanks for sending those soil samples in. And I would mention this for any of our listeners. If you've got soil samples and would like another opinion or you have a question on them, we'd certainly be happy to look at them. You can just email us, radio@agphd.com. I got one from Ryland here. And Ryland said, I want to sign up for the Neil Kinsey workshop in March of 2020. And I was seeing that there's a deadline for sending in soil samples, and it was October 1st. If we sign up now, can we still send soil samples in, or are we just out of luck on that one?
No, and honestly, it was me that put down, try to send your soil samples in by October 1st. And the reason why I did that is because Neil just gets so busy, his lab is busy, and I want to make sure that he had plenty of time to get the samples in, get them done, and that you actually got them pulled. Because once it starts getting to November, December, ground gets cold, and who knows if you'll get it done or not. So just try to get it done as soon as you can, and hopefully you've got the data when you're actually at the workshop.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to talk through those samples and, of course, get Neil's take on all those things, too. Brian and I are really looking forward to that workshop coming up this winter. You can find all the details at agphd.com. Thanks for listening to our program today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio. Now, stay tuned for Rob Sharkey and Shark Farmer Radio.